Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. There is a fault line that should strike greater fear in your hearts than the San Andreas or the Hayward. The Cascadia subduction zone runs off the U.S. West Coast from Cape Mendocino in California north to Vancouver Island in Canada. The 700-mile fault zone has the potential to unleash such an enormous earthquake and tsunami that, in the words of one expert, quote, everything west of Interstate 5 will be toast. The New Yorker's Catherine Schulz is with us. She's written about this in her article, The Really Big One, which appears in the magazine's latest issue. And we welcome her to the program from Portland, Oregon. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Also want to welcome Richard Allen, known to Forum listeners, been on with us before talking about earthquakes. He directs the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory and is professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. Richard Allen, good to have you back on Forum.
Great to be back with you, Michael.
Thank you. And Catherine Schulz, let me begin with you because this is scary stuff. There's no getting around it. And I want listeners at least to be aware of what we're talking about here and perhaps what can be done. In your article, you talk about these, the subduction phenomenon, let's call it, refers to tectonic plates, really. And in a way that I think is very graphic and visual, you talk about putting hands with palms down. Let's go through that just quickly, if you could, so that people can understand what we're talking about here.
Sure. So what's going on in the Pacific Northwest is that two tectonic plates are essentially having this kind of secret subterranean conflict where none of us can see it, but obviously with huge consequences for those of us living on top. All of us here in the United States are sitting on top of the North American plate, and that's one of the two plates involved in this conflict. The other is an oceanic plate. It's called the Juan de Fuca plate. And the Juan de Fuca plate is essentially trying to move eastward. It's pushing against the North American plate and sliding beneath it. And instead of just kind of freely slipping over the top of it, the North American plate is stuck. And so it's essentially getting compressed by this big, heavy oceanic plate. It's being pushed eastward. It's sort of bulging upward. And these are in tiny increments, but year over year they add up. And, you know, eventually there's going to be too much tension in that plate and it's going to spring back. It's going to rebound, basically. And when it does so, the kind of edge of the continent, the northwest coast of the continent, is going to bounce back to the position it's been edged out of for all of these last, at this point, 315 years. So you're going to see a big spring westward. You're going to see the land drop some, and that's effectively the earthquake. And when that drop takes place, some of it's going to happen underwater. It's going to displace a huge amount of ocean. And that is how you wind up getting the tsunami that's correlated with that earthquake.
And we're talking about really big-time Fukushima here. 30 years ago, no one knew about this, and no one knew it had produced an earthquake. 45 years ago, no one knew it even existed.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's important to remember that plate tectonics itself is a relatively young field. The idea has been kicking around since the 1910s or teens, but it wasn't really broadly accepted within the geological community until the mid-1960s. And this particular fault line, there's a lot of subduction zones around the world. The Cascadia one is a little bit unusual in that it's very quiet. Most subduction zones, you get a lot of interim activity between these huge earthquakes. You don't have to be a genius or a seismologist to live in one of those regions and recognize that you probably live on a fault line. In Cascadia, there's no reason to know that you would be sitting on top of something this huge because it has this strange kind of eerie silence about it. So we really did just learn about it for sure in sort of the mid-1990s. And of course, what's scary about that is by then, what had we done? We'd built a lot of major cities. We'd built a lot of highways. We'd built an infrastructure.
We built a civilization.
We built a civilization, essentially. And that civilization did not have the advantage of knowing that it faced significant seismic risk. And so now we're scrambling to try to figure out, well, how do we, now that we do know this, how do we make that area safer?
Well, let's talk to a seismologist. Richard Allen, as Catherine Schulz points out in her article now, we have learned a great deal more. And we know, for example, about what's happened in the zone with earthquakes going back about 10,000 years. And there are time lapses. And there's ways of perhaps perceiving, well, what might happen in terms of seismic activity with respect to those time lapses. So I know we really can't. We're still at a stage where we can't predict earthquakes, but it's almost as if something is overdue there when you read her article.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. As obviously, as Catherine's been laying out, it's really quite a remarkable scientific discovery. It's a scientific story, detective story, how we figured out what was going on in the Pacific Northwest. But we have known about this, of course, for several decades. And so to your question about the time lapse, the challenge, as Catherine also pointed out, was how can we really see what is going on in the Cascadia subduction zone, because so much of it is below the ocean. And so that's where some part of the new discovery came from Chris Goldfinger's core samples out in the ocean. He's the one that has pieced together the time history of what's been going on in the Cascadia subduction zone. And Catherine talks about this in her article. What he finds is that sometimes we have what we would call relatively small earthquakes for Cascadia, but they're magnitude 8 type earthquakes, and they seem to sometimes just rupture the southern part of the Cascadia subduction zone, but sometimes they rupture the entire Cascadia subduction zone, and that's the magnitude 9 scenario that Catherine talks about in her article, and it's a truly scary scenario. But it's an important distinction. This is a real scenario. This isn't a Hollywood movie like the San Andreas movie earlier this year. This is a real scenario, magnitude 9 earthquake along the entire Cascadia subduction zone. And the recurrence intervals, they vary depending on the magnitude. For the smaller magnitude events, the magnitude 8, then we're talking about a recurrence of about every 250 years. But for the big events, it's about 580 years. And the last one was in 1700. So in a sense, you could think of us as being somewhat overdue at this, for the smaller end of the magnitude scale, the magnitude 8 events, but they're still huge earthquakes. But we're not overdue in the sense for the large magnitude event. And so the question now is, what do we do with this information? How are we going to take this information? How are we going to get ourselves prepared and prevent that natural?
Well, that's exactly what I'd like to go into before we get our listeners involved in this discussion. But from what I read in Catherine's article, you could have damage as far as Sacramento.
That's right. I mean, big earthquakes like this, they cause shaking hundreds of kilometers away. Some of the listeners may remember that in the magnitude 9 Tohoku-Oki earthquake in Japan in 2011, that was offshore, sort of the northern portion of Japan, but there was incredible video of the skyscrapers in Tokyo swaying. The low-frequency energy travels very long distances, and the skyscrapers were swaying backwards and forwards. Of course, they were engineered to withstand that. And so the question is, have we engineered our infrastructure down the entire West Coast to withstand these kinds of events?
I think the answer probably to that, Catherine Schulz, is no. In fact, up in the Pacific Northwest, there's really no early warning system.
Well, that's right. Go ahead, Catherine.
I'm happy to defer to you as well. But the short answer to that question is no. We don't have an early warning system in the Pacific Northwest. And we also do not have anything like the kinds of engineering standards that Japan enjoys and that protected a lot of those buildings, even in that really massive 2011 earthquake. Some areas are a little bit better off than others, but it is the case across the region that we really did not have robust sort of magnitude 9 level seismic code in place until, in Oregon, really until the mid-1990s. And when you think about it, most of the state was built up before then.
You can add something, Richard?
Sure, but as the forum listeners know, we are very close to actually building an earthquake early warning system. That's something that started here in California and was recently extended up to the Pacific Northwest. So, in fact, the University of Washington, the Pacific Seismic Network, Pacific Northwest Seismic Network, is now testing an early warning system based on the one that we developed here at Berkeley. And so, again, we don't have it, as Catherine says, yet, but we're very close to having that early warning system along the entire West Coast. And I'll note there was a great editorial in the Seattle Times, spurred by Catherine's article in their paper today, urging legislators to actually fund the West Coast early warning system. Let's get this done.
Well, if this is beginning to sound like Cassandra, doomsday and all that sort of thing, it should be of concern to those of us who live here on the West Coast. And I remember Kurt Gentry's book, some of you may as well, The Late Great State of California, where we're supposed to fall into the ocean. But we're talking about a reality here where something along those lines could indeed take place. We're talking about really the whole Ring of Fire, which is really a subduction zone in itself. And let's hear from you. Before we do, I want to just give you a sense of the article that we're talking about, which is on our website, and you can access that Catherine Schulz did for The New Yorker. She pretty much outlines what the specifics are in terms of Well, what would happen? Soon after the shaking begins, the electric grid will fail, likely everywhere west of the Cascades and possibly well beyond. And if it happens at night, the ensuing catastrophe will unfold in darkness. In theory, those who are at home when it hits should be safest. It is easy and relatively inexpensive to seismically safeguard a private dwelling. But lulled into nonchalance by their seemingly benign environment, most people in the Pacific Northwest have not done so. That nonchalance will shatter instantly. So will everything made of glass. Anything indoors and unsecured will lurch across the floor or come crashing down. Bookshelves, lamps, computers, canisters of flour in the pantry. Refrigerators will walk out of kitchens, unplugging themselves and toppling over. Water heaters will fall and smash interior gas lines. Houses that are not bolted to their foundations will slide off, or rather they will stay put, obeying inertia, while the foundations, together with the rest of the Northwest, jolt westward. Unmoored on the undulating ground, the homes will begin to collapse. What do you say to people who say, well, that sounds too doomsday, too pessimistic, Catherine Schulz?
I say it's not. You know, look, you know, as we just heard from a seismologist, we are talking about a worst-case scenario along this fault line, but we are not talking about a drummed-up or an imaginary scenario. And we also know that there are lesser scenarios that will also be very, very potent. I mean, a magnitude 8, a magnitude 8.2 quake along this fault line, look, that's, you know, that's the high end of the San Andreas. So whatever happens here, we're talking about really very, very powerful seismic waves. They will take houses off of their foundations if those houses aren't bolted down. And I think the real moral of the story is, look, a lot of these areas, you know, Seattle is sitting on top of an entire other fault line, the Seattle Fault. Seismic risk is real in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, we just spoke about an early warning system. In a way, articles like this are their own kind of early warning system. This is not a we're all going to die catastrophe. There's a lot of steps people can take to make themselves safer, their homes safer, their children and families safer. A lot of them are relatively straightforward, like bolting your house to your foundation. Do it. You'll buy yourself a lot of peace of mind. And the risk that we're protecting against here, or urging you to protect yourself against, is very real.
Well, let me find out what your listeners have to say or ask about this, and I need to remind you that we're talking mainly about the Northwest up in Washington and Oregon State, not so much California, although, as we've indicated, this could certainly be felt as far as Sacramento. But the subduction zone runs off the U.S. West Coast from Cape Mendocino in California. We do have many listeners up there, north all the way to the Vancouver Island in Canada. We do invite your calls, and you can join us now with any questions or comments you might have. The toll-free number to reach us, 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number is available. That's 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email any questions or comments you might have. Email address is forum@kqed.org. Or post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Talking about, as the title of the article in the New Yorker says, the really big one, as opposed to what we've been calling the big one, and that you may never have heard of before. Catherine Schulz with us, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the June 20th story, The Really Big One, which, as I said, is now on our website, and Richard Allen, director of the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory and professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. And we'll bring you into this question as well. Let's just talk about the odds for a moment, Richard Allen. Chris Goldfinger, whom you mentioned earlier, said odds 1 to 3, and his colleagues came together and said odds are very big, maybe 1 in 10. I mean, I don't know how you break these down.
Sure. So the difference between those two numbers, again, comes to the magnitude. So the smaller, in inverted commas, of the events in the Cascadia subduction zone, a magnitude 8-type earthquake, the odds of those in the next 50 years is about 1 in 3. But the big ones, the magnitude 9, the scenario that Catherine lays out, the odds of that are about 1 in 10 in the next 50 years. Again, it's the difference between a recurrence interval of about 250 years for the magnitude 8 and a recurrence interval of about 580 years for the magnitude 9s. But again, as Catherine points out in her article, these are averages, and there can be significant variation in the recurrence interval. And so the message here really is that we need to be ready for these earthquakes. We could be having one of these earthquakes very soon. We can hope that we won't have one of these earthquakes for a number of years, and that brings us to this strategy of how we start to prepare for this earthquake when it comes, because it is going to come.
Well, Brian tweets to us, it isn't a real scenario, it's simply a scenario. This is old news, great sensation, however. And what do you say, Richard Allen?
Well, as Catherine said, this is a science-based scenario. I think it's a little unfortunate, to be honest, that this quote about toast, that everything west of Interstate 5 will be toast, because it implies that there's nothing we can do, and that is absolutely wrong. It is not that all of the buildings will be destroyed, as we saw in the recent San Andreas movie in the region. There will be some buildings that will survive, and there will be some buildings that are destroyed. And the difference between those two buildings is those that were built to modern engineering standards that take into account the kind of shaking we expect. People's homes where they've gone and done the retrofits, the simple retrofits that Catherine mentioned of bolting to your foundation that cost just a few thousand dollars, and that can make the difference between your house surviving the earthquake and the next door neighbor's house falling off the foundations. So this is a real scenario, and it should be a warning to us that we need to think about how we personally are taking responsibility for our future and the future of our children.
All right, let me go to your calls, and we begin with David. David, join us. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two comments. The first is about bolting to the foundation. The experience in Northridge showed that bolting to the foundation is insufficient because bolted foundation sill, the framing above it will simply rip off and walk away with the house. If the framing itself is not also bolted to the foundation. So the sill has to be bolted and the framing as well. And my second comment is that Mexico already has an early warning system in place that's functional. I had enough warning to get out of a little museum in Mexico City about a year ago. So they're actually ahead of us in that, and I think it's time for us to catch up.
All right. I thank you for your comments. Good to hear from you, David. We'll hear from some more of you in a moment. I wanted to go to some reactions to Catherine Scholl's article from our listeners on our Facebook page. A listener writes, "There is no exaggeration about the possibility happening. If I lived there and had a family and people I was responsible for, I would be making plans to move." Christina writes, "Why is this suddenly news? There are at least three faults running through metropolitan Seattle alone. Do they not teach earthquake safety and awareness in the state of Washington? I remember learning that in California elementary schools. The fact that Washington is destined for earthquakes is news literally as old as the earth itself. Seems like fear-mongering to me." And Kelly says, "In a perfect world, the government would take quick action to make sure that the Northwest is completely prepared for this impending disaster. Of course, that's not the world we live in. And as we've seen with the levees of Louisiana and Hurricane Katrina, and as in the latter part of the article, which states, the people in power will simply cross their fingers, spend zero to little resources on preparedness, hoping that when the very big one hits, the damage done won't be as bad as projected. How many more disasters need to strike before the majority of people stop burying their heads in the sand when it comes to seismic fact and preparedness?" Richard Elling, go to you with an email question here. Wants to know, would a quake of this nature also trigger the eruption of Mount Baker, Rainier, Hood, Adams, St. Helens, or vice versa? The Oregon coast does have tsunami signs and routes.
That's a great question. We know that earthquakes can trigger volcanic eruptions, and we've seen that happen in the past. People have done studies looking at the number of eruptions in the days after large magnitude earthquakes, and the likelihood of there being eruption is actually higher immediately after a big earthquake than the normal background by a factor of about four. So it's true, in a sense, the scenario that Catherine laid out isn't the worst-case scenario. The worst-case scenario might actually add a volcanic eruption on top of the earthquake that she's talking about. If I can add another comment, that this challenge about government not reacting to this is exactly right, and there are various political reasons that I think we all understand that that happens. What we need to do is come up with a cross-disciplinary strike teams to deal with these kinds of hazards and these kinds of problems. What we've learned in seismology as we've been working on the early warning system is it's not just about the seismology, the science, it's about the engineering, it's about the public policy, it's about the law, it's about business incentives. And so what we actually need to do is develop these kind of cross-disciplinary teams that can actually look at the hazard, come up with solutions, and communicate these solutions effectively to our government agencies, government bodies, legislators. And that's something we're actually trying to figure out how we can do that here at UC Berkeley with a Center for Natural Catastrophe Prevention.
Richard, could you also address a question which has just come across the transom here from a listener by email who wants to know if you could differentiate the California impacts from Washington and Oregon?
I'm not sure I understand. You mean the impacts of the earthquake?
Yes.
So the magnitude 9 earthquake has about 30 times as much energy as a magnitude 8 earthquake. The largest sort of scenario earthquakes we think about for the San Andreas are about a magnitude 8 earthquake. And so that's what makes the Pacific Northwest the really big one.
Isn't it a little higher? I've read, 8.2 in terms of San Andreas.
Sure, that's true. It could be a little bit higher. I guess I'm talking in round numbers. But what this actually means is this: what we have to worry about is the strength of shaking. And the strength of shaking that you experience at your home is not just based on the magnitude, it's also based on how far you are from the fault that is rupturing. And so the difference between the Pacific Northwest Cascadia event and the San Andreas is that the Cascadia event is offshore. So everybody is some distance from the earthquake, whereas with the San Andreas fault, as we all know, we have lots of people living right on top of the fault. So we have a lot of people very close to the fault. So I'm not getting into a competition here about whose earthquake is bigger, but I don't think we should sit back and think that, magnitude 8 is not so bad after all. Clearly, that's not the case.
And again, Richard Allen directs the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory and is professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley. And our next caller is Amelia. Good morning.
Good morning. I grew up in Washington, west of I-5. My parents still live there, and we live right on the Puget Sound. So my question is, how much can that area anticipate a tsunami? Like, is the tsunami going to go up the Strait of Juan de Fuca and hit the Puget Sound as well? Is the water going to rise a lot? Because, again, I grew up right on the Puget Sound.
Yeah, can you help us, Eric, from your research, Catherine Schulz?
Sure, and Richard, feel free to jump in and correct me if I get this wrong, but my understanding is that no, the Puget Sound is not at risk from a tsunami. It's large enough that it's going to protect the people who live around there, which isn't to say you won't face other risks from the earthquake itself. But no, the tsunami is going to be absolutely devastating, but in a relatively narrow area. There is a strip along the coast, the tsunami inundation zone, where frankly the destruction will be near total.
Well, at least we don't have anything nuclear.
But it's
there.
Very small.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. I should say, unlike Fukushima, we don't have at least anything nuclear up there near where the tsunami would hit. But let me get another caller on here from Washington, D.C. Michael, that's you. Good morning.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I just wanted to make a quick comment in the form of an analogy regarding the complacency factor. I just read the Johnstown Flood by David McCullough, and that's an example where the communities, the governments, and the owners of the South Fork Dam all knew that there was incredible risk, but nobody did anything. And they never thought it would actually happen. And it did happen, and it led to a great calamity.
Well, thank you for that perspective. Good to hear from you. And we'll hear next from Ruth Ann. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to piggyback on a prior question about and ask Dr. Richard Allen that in a really big one, if the forces would be great enough that even if your home was bolted down, foundation at all, would it push the house off the foundation? I'm just wondering, basic physics, if you're really holding down something strongly on one part, the weakest part of the chain is going to come off.
Yeah, so of course, the first thing to point out is that any kind of effort to retrofit buildings, there's no such thing as an earthquake-proof building, okay? So we can't build buildings that are earthquake-proof. What we can do is we can take reasonable measures to make buildings as safe as possible. There's no absolutes, unfortunately, in this.
People use that language, though, all the time, Richard. I'm sure you're well aware of it. It's always bothered me. They'll say, this is earthquake-proof.
Yeah, and it is right. That's not. You will never hear a seismologist or a seismic engineer use that language. What we can do is we can come up with our best estimates of the kind of ground shaking. Engineers can then engineer the buildings to be able to withstand that kind of shaking. And so it's a best effort kind of approach. So there's no such thing as earthquake-proof. But having said that, we know that bolting houses to foundations works. There's plenty of recommendations from plenty of groups who show that this is what really makes a difference and that this is what people should do. Now, when it comes to the specifics of any individual house, obviously you need an engineer to come and look at it and make those kinds of decisions. But taking these kind of fairly simple, straightforward actions to safeguard your own property is a very smart thing to do.
I want to read a tweet here from a listener who says, if a quake could be felt in Sacramento, then the Delta levee system is at peril. That is an end to the state. Another listener writes, how far and severe would a resulting tsunami reach down the coast of California following the Cascadia fault break? Would it reach Southern California? And how likely would Northwest quake trigger San Andreas or Hayward faults? Richard?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question. Chris Goldfinger has also looked at this question of whether there's a correlation between the timing of these Cascadia zone, subduction zone events and San Andreas events. And I would say that it's not clear whether there is or not, but there are indications that it might be possible. And so there is this scenario where a really big earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone could trigger an earthquake on the San Andreas fault, but it's very difficult to really determine the degree to which that's happened in the past because it needs very accurate dates on both the San Andreas and the Cascadia subduction zone. But it is a possibility.
Well, on the other hand, here's a listener who writes, if you look at the 10,000-year history at the Dot Earth blog, which is on the New York Times, you see that there have never been 3 9.0 quakes in a row. The last two were of this magnitude. Does this suggest any possibility of a partial margin release instead of a full margin release? And would not both an 8.0 and a 9.0 be catastrophic?
Well, to the answer to the last question first, yes, both a magnitude 8.0 and a magnitude 9.0 on the Cascadia subduction zone would be catastrophic. The question of whether they come in sequence or not, I'm not sure I would want to interpret that as being an indication of whether we're going to get an 8 or a magnitude 9. And I guess as the listener was pointing out, I'm not sure it really makes a difference. We need to make sure we're taking the same actions to prepare for either one of them.
And what about the raising of the question about the Sacramento levees?
Well, that is a scenario that's been discussed quite extensively just from earthquakes, the small, old-fashioned local earthquakes here in Northern California. Whether it be an earthquake on the San Andreas Fault or on the Hayward Fault, people are very concerned that the ground shaking associated with that could cause collapse of the levees. And as your listeners know, much of the land surface around in the Sacramento Delta is below sea level. And so the scary scenario is that you collapse those levees. It has to fill up with water from somewhere. That water is going to be sucked in from the San Francisco Bay, and suddenly the entire delta area is covered in salt water. Now, why is that a catastrophe? Obviously, there's the immediate impact to the people in the region, but a lot of Southern California's drinking water actually passes through the delta system, comes from the rivers in the north, and goes to the aquifers at the southern side of the delta and is then piped down to Southern California. So that could destroy a significant fraction of drinking water supply.
Oh, California. Boy. Well, at least we've got some good news coming in the hour ahead. We're going to talk about working moms and the effect on their daughters and sons, which is positive in a new study out of Harvard Business School. Thank you, Richard Allen. Richard Allen directs the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory. And thank you, Catherine Scholes, who is staff writer with The New Yorker and author of the June 20 story, The Really Big One. And thank you, our listeners. Back for another hour when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.